This is Ryan Underwood, business editor at Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management. As the national healthcare reform law moves towards implementation, critics continue their efforts to block it. Two federal judges have ruled that it's unconstitutional, several state legislatures have voted not to abide by some of the law's components, and the U.S. House and Senate are considering separate repeal measures. So where does all this leave those in the healthcare industry? To help businesses get a better read on the situation, we're talking to Larry Van Horn, Associate Professor of Healthcare Management and Executive Director of Health Affairs at Owen. Larry, what do you tell businesses in the healthcare arena that are confused about the future of this law and where it's going?
It's okay to be confused. The reality is that there is a lot yet to be written in terms of the legislation, and there's a lot of ambiguity with respect to specific provisions and how that's going to likely impact both healthcare financing and delivery. At the end of the day, healthcare reform legislation, the words the secretary shall appear over 1,000 times. And a lot of that subjectivity has got to be taken out and codified. So while I think that directionally we know what the intent was, the specifics are still being written.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing confusion? I mean, as you talk to businesses, is that what you're hearing from them?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of interest right now in the Accountable Care Organization incentives and legislation, as well as most recently, a couple weeks ago, the value-based purchasing initiatives that came out. But these are our initial stabs at what the final legislation will look like, and they're receiving comment back. And the devil's going to be in the details.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as we see those details codified, we're going to be in a much better position to know what should our specific actions be. So my general feeling is, stay tuned in, to the best of your ability, understand what's going on. But in the meantime, just make good, sound business decisions around healthcare delivery that will empower you regardless of how the specifics play out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there any big implementation deadlines that you see coming, or are those still to be written in the regulations?
Well, a lot of this is to be written. I mean, the value-based purchasing initiative is due to kick in October of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a hard number there around incentives for particular quality performance and quality metrics. And they're receiving comment on that right now. The ACO push and initiatives, we went through this once in the 1990s. It was called Integrated Delivery Systems. So we'll see how that ends up unfolding. But at the end of the day, to be successful in any of these areas, whether it's with respect to accountable care organizations, integration of clinical service delivery, whether it's pushing improved quality, it all boils down to running the business of healthcare delivery well, which is understanding the production process, trying to minimize variation, trying to have an insight into cost of care delivery, and having a better sense for the relationship between the inpatient setting and the outpatient setting and the clinical care coordination. That's always going to be a win. And what that specifically means for hospital strategy, I think will become clearer over the next year.
Are there some areas that you think are being maybe talked about now that you end up, you see maybe ending up as a fad or not being critical to any kind of compliance or anything like that?
Well, one of the areas that people are very interested in right now is the role of accountable care organizations. The goal here is simple. It's to change the incentives associated with healthcare delivery from a per-click revenue model to one where individuals, organizations do better by managing the totality of care. To support that, you have to change the way providers are paid and move to some capitated or global payment detached from the individual service provision. Last time we went through healthcare reform efforts, and at that time it was Hillary Care, in the early to mid-90s, the follow-on to that was a big push to form integrated delivery systems. I think for those who've been in the healthcare industry for a while, you should draw some parallels and similarity between ACOs and integrated delivery systems. Now, what we saw is integrated delivery systems ushered in a period of primary care physician practice acquisition, healthcare delivery systems starting their own managed care products through the late 1990s. And then you saw 2000s being the time period of unwinding a lot of that activity because we never saw the fundamental change in the reimbursement to foster and reinforce the incentives for coordinated care delivery. So I'm jaded, and that's a hard thing to do. I understand the proposition, it's laudable, but if we don't get to a world where we are contracting on a global at-risk basis with providers detached from the individual service provision, I think I'm concerned that we would go down a path that we've seen before of expending significant resources without corresponding gains.
Well, there are some efforts underway in Congress right now, both in the House and Senate, to repeal the healthcare law. And President Obama had said in his State of the Union speech that he's willing to work with lawmakers to revise some parts of the law. What kind of an impact does that have on business? What kind of signals are being sent from Washington to practitioners and to those within the industry?
Well, I think the reality is while the House passed legislation to repeal, we know it wasn't engaged in the Senate, and this isn't going to be repealed anytime soon. I think there is bipartisan interest in moving on some components of the healthcare reform legislation and making modification to that. Most notably is the reporting requirements for around 1099s for small businesses on contractors on which you spend more than $600. I think there's also interest in addressing the flexible spending account uses and provisions. And finally, probably the only area where there could be a whole-scale repeal of the law would be with respect to the class provision for community-based long-term care services, which was about a $70 billion line item that most folks, question the validity of. So those are really minor areas in the grand scheme of things. That are likely to be addressed, but there's nothing in the near term that's going to result in a game change with respect to the legislation.
The other thing that's happening is there have been these court decisions, two federal court decisions, ruling against a provision in the healthcare law that about the individual mandate that requires individuals to have health insurance. And you had written about this in your blog, but I want to have you just explain it. If that part of the law is overturned, then that kind of throws the requirements on health insurers into a little bit of chaos. Can you explain that?
Well, the economics of this are simple. The constitutionality, I guess, is a little less clear. So I'm just going to stick to the world that's nice and clear. If you allow individuals to only purchase insurance when they feel they need it, we suffer something called adverse selection. And that is the only people who end up buying are the people who are sick. And so the individual mandate was an attempt to say, hey, everybody's got to play. And that kind of makes intuitive sense, particularly when coupled with the proposition that insurers are faced with, that our ability to underwrite is limited, and we can't eliminate people based on pre-existing conditions. So the goal is laudatory to get everybody to participate. The reality is that the penalties are really quite modest. And most individuals don't fundamentally understand insurance. I find repeatedly that when I ask my graduate students who are 20-somethings whether they need health insurance, unfortunately, many of them say they don't. And that just is proof positive that they need to spend more time getting educated because everybody needs insurance. But there's a difference between insurance and prepaid healthcare consumption. And mandating that everybody pay in to get prepaid healthcare consumption is a tough nut to crack fiscally. Having everybody pay in to have their catastrophic risk covered is a different proposition. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. At the end of the day, whether this is upheld or overturned, it's not a game changer in terms of solving the fundamental unsustainability of our financing system for healthcare.
Right, right. Let's just assume that this element of the law is ruled unconstitutional. It's taken out. What happens then? Because, I mean, as you say, this would with the other requirements in the law, this would essentially allow someone to buy health insurance on the way to the hospital.
Right.
And they wouldn't, an insurance company wouldn't be able to turn them down, which is where the problem.
It's a bad thing.
Problem.
Yes. And so that's clearly not a sustainable equilibrium, because then unfortunately a large number of individuals are unlikely to purchase health insurance.
Right.
Now, the alternative is that we could have providers not deliver care to people who haven't had insurance, who don't have insurance. But that puts us in a position that we're not comfortable as a society with putting our delivery system in a position where they withhold care.
Mm-hmm.
There was this really nice example of this in the case of fire insurance here in Tennessee last fall, where an individual's house burned down and the fire department let it burn down because the individual hadn't paid for their fire insurance.
Right.
And that's not efficient or ideal. So if individuals all understood insurance and made nice, sound decisions that we as an economist think they should make, we wouldn't have this problem. But most people don't value insurance. They wouldn't purchase auto insurance if it wasn't compulsory. They probably wouldn't purchase homeowners insurance unless their mortgage, their bank, and their mortgage holder compelled them to purchase insurance. People just don't understand that it's for those rainy days that you need to have that coverage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if this individual mandate was repealed, what does that mean? Does that mean, do you see the law being repealed? Do you see it just being kind of a moot point? What happens then?
Well, I don't see it being repealed. And the reality is that it would leave us much where we are right now. Hospital emergency rooms, through a law called EMTALA, are required to provide care to any individual who shows up. There's already an unfunded mandate on the delivery system, regardless of an individual's ability to pay, to supply them care. But what we're doing here is we're trying to institutionalize and explicitly create a transfer through the tax system and through the individual mandate that hospitals have always done internally.
Mm-hmm.
They've always increased the prices to insurance companies so that they could cover their uninsured burden. We were trying to minimize that in this legislation, and so we're going to be left much where we are right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And any big changes that you see? You mentioned some earlier, but anything you in your crystal ball see coming between now and 2012 or even after that?
I think what it'll be very interesting to see how our general economy rebounds and how what happens to unemployment and what happens in global markets, because as well as state finances. As we expand the federal and state government's commitment to fund healthcare services, it becomes increasingly interdependent with the overall fiscal health of both the federal and state government. And we have a significant deficit and debt at both the federal government as well as in many states. And I think many are suggesting that our ability to play kick the can on that is coming to an end. And so if you have to rein back on spending and an increasing portion of that spending is in healthcare, it does call into question how are you going to end up tailoring and changing the scope of healthcare coverage through Medicaid and Medicare. The Secretary Sebelius last week issued preliminary guidance to governors saying, hey, when you look at trying to rein in your Medicaid spending, I don't want to see you doing it through cutting the eligibility criteria. I want to see you doing it through curtailing scope of benefits, increasing cost sharing, and making modest reductions in the generosity of the plans. I think it's only reasonable for our providers out there to look forward and consider the fact that we are probably going to see increased top-line pressure. We're going to see greater, more re-examination of the scope of benefits that are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial payers. And one can think about what things are likely going to be on the chopping block. Things that are more elective, less acute in nature, are probably going to come under increased scrutiny. And so preparing oneself for that would be sensible.
Okay. All right, this is great. Thanks so much, Larry.